So it's November 2nd, 2011 at the Loft in Auckland. So, nice to be here. I haven't been in Auckland for a long time. Do you introduce your speaker or should I just...
Yeah, but just sign this. Okay.
So if you have a Bhagavad Gita, you can turn to page 588, which is chapter 13, text 21. We're going to be looking at chapter 13, text 21 and 22, and then we're going to jump from there to chapter 14, text 21. I'm going to do 13, 21, 22, then 14, 21. So I'm ready when anyone wants.
Okay. So welcome everyone, thank you for coming. Just like to say a little bit Father Amala,
So again, if you have a Bhagavad Gita, I'm not sure if there's any left in the shelf. But if you have a Bhagavad Gita, you can turn to 588, and then we're going to jump from there to 621. All right. So what we're going to look at tonight are problems and solutions. Getting to the essence of all of our problems and a one-step solution. So we might consider what are the problems that have been weighing on our mind the last today or maybe the last week or the last month. Maybe we have some issue with our health that we're worried about, or some friend of ours has some health issue, or maybe worried about money, or a place to live, or what we're going to study in school, or whether the person we love loves us in return, or whether they're going to leave us, or do we have somebody who's trying to cause us trouble at home or at school or at work? Do we have some anxieties about the future? Is there going to be an environmental collapse or an economic collapse? So we have so many things that concern us. But Krishna tells us that actually the cause of all of our problems is not what's happening externally in the world. He says something very interesting in chapter 13, which is nature, the enjoyer, and consciousness. He says, Prakritim, Purusha Chaiva. Material nature and the living entity should be understood to be beginningless. And then he says, nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of the various sufferings and enjoyments in this world. And where do those sufferings come from? Purusha Prakriti Stohi, Bhunte Prakriti Jan Gunam, Karanam Guna Sangosya, Sadasad Yoni Janmashu. Karanam, karna means the cause, Guna Sangasya. That the cause of all of our happiness in life and all of our problems in life is that we're associating ourselves with something called the gunas, or the modes of material nature. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna goes through a lot of explanation of the modes of material nature. In the 14th chapter, he gives a very general description. And in the 17th and 18th chapter, he gives a very specific description. And there are three modes called, in Sanskrit, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva means good or truth. Something that's good and something that's true. Something that's authentic, something that's real. Raja can mean a king. It also means passion. And tama means ignorance. So we usually say goodness, passion, and ignorance. Something like the colors red, yellow, and blue. That you have a combination of these colors and you can form so many other colors. And if you think that you use just basic three colors and by having the light colors, you can create a picture. Isn't it? There's a projection screen and it's projecting light. Just three colors of light moving around and they create a picture. And they can create a movie picture. They can create a movie, or nowadays you can even create a 3D. Do you have any 3D IMAX theaters here in New Zealand? So you can create, have an IMAX theater where it's like several stories high. My mother used to take the kids and I to see nature films and these things, you know. And you actually put on these 3D glasses and you feel like you're going through the jungles and you're, you know, the tiger's jumping out at you. And it's just three different colors. So you're thinking this is all this experience that I'm having, but it's just three different colors of light. So all of our experiences in this world are simply these three modes of nature combining in various ways, and we're simply the witness. Krishna goes on and saying, whatever you see in existence, this is text 27 in chapter 13, whatever you see in existence, both the moving and non-moving, is only a combination of this field of activities, these moving lights, of the modes of material nature, and the knower of the field. And he goes on to explain in text 30, one can see that all activities are performed by the body, which is created of material nature, and sees that the self does nothing, actually sees. What does that mean, that we're doing nothing? That everything is just being performed by the body and nature. I am just the witness. I'm having an indirect, vicarious experience. I'm not actually experiencing the things in this world. The same way as if I'm watching the movie, I'm not actually experiencing the things in the movie. But it feels like I am, doesn't it? You know, if you're watching, especially if it's a really good movie, you identify with the character in the movie. And when the character is happy, you feel happy. And when the character is scared, you feel scared. Doesn't it work like that? I mean, you actually get physiological symptoms that match what's happening in the movie. Your heart starts beating, right? You start sweating. You start laughing. You start crying. Or you're scared. So it's as if you're having that experience. The same thing's true when you read a book, if you're playing a computer game. You're not actually experiencing it, but you are experiencing it. You could say, what are you doing? I'm just sitting in my chair in the movie theater or on my couch or whatever. I'm not really jumping out of the helicopter. I'm not really getting the handsome man or the beautiful girl. I'm not really winning the money or losing the money. I'm not running from the bad guys or shooting the bad guys or whatever. But I feel as if I am. I mean, another experience, of course, is a dream, where it seems like I'm running away from somebody with a gun, or I'm going here, or I'm going there, and I'm actually just lying in my bed. But it's as if I'm experiencing that. So a movie's a particularly good experience because it's made of three colors of lights. And this world is made up just exactly like that, of the three modes of material nature combined in different ways to create stories. Now, why do we think that our experience here is reality? How do we know the difference between something that's real and something that's not real? Why do I decide that my dreams are not real, but my waking experience is real? Any ideas? I wake up from my dreams. Well, how do I know that when I'm awake, I'm actually dreaming, and when I go to sleep, I'm awake? I mean, how do I decide that the waking life is the real life and the sleeping life is not the real life?
Subconscious.
Well, I have some consciousness when I'm sleeping. I must have some consciousness when I'm sleeping.
Feels like you have control.
But when I'm dreaming, I generally think that I have some control. It's only in retrospect after I wake up that I realize that I wasn't really in control of the dream. But during the dream, it doesn't exactly feel like that. I feel like it's a real experience while I'm dreaming.
That's the majority of your time is spent awake. It's like the thing you always come back to.
Could be that, although that's perhaps not true for everybody. In other words, that's not the only criteria, is how much time you spend in it. Definitely, most of us spend more time awake. Any other thoughts?
It's more consistent, maybe, that you come back to the waking world.
Okay, there's certainly some consistency. that when I dream, I'm in all different places, and when I wake up, I'm usually in the same place as I'm traveling. I've been in situations where I'm traveling so much that when I wake up, I don't know where I am or what direction I'm facing or where my bed is in relationship to the rest of the room. That's happened when I'm traveling. Any other ideas why we consider dreams not real and waking life real?
Have
some more awareness of our body. Of course, in a dream, you think you're aware of your body when you're dreaming.
Yeah, it seems to be that while we are awake, we feel our body more.
Because when you look at clocks in your dream, they don't make any sense.
Okay. But, you know, that could be just my conditioning.
Unusual things occur in dreams?
Well, you only call them unusual in relationship to waking, though.
Yeah, of course. Meaning that there's
a lot of these answers, they're assuming the answer. I'm assuming that my wakeful life is real, and I'm comparing dreams to waking, and I'm saying that there's a difference, and therefore, because they don't correspond to the waking life, I assume that one is real, one is unreal. Any other thoughts?
I don't dream of Krishna.
You don't dream of Krishna, but when you're awake, you see Krishna. Sometimes you might dream of Krishna. I know some people who dream of Krishna. Any other thoughts? You know that both our waking and sleeping experiences are happening only within the mind.
Does waking life has continuity?
Yeah, since we mentioned that. You mentioned that. That there's a kind of continuity, whereas dreaming life doesn't have continuity. Sometimes. Sometimes I have dreams several nights in a row that have continuity, but generally not. But it could just be a longer dream. I think it's also because I can collaborate my waking experience with other people. We'll all agree that we're in this room right now. Whereas if I have a dream about you, you don't have that same dream about me. So if I say, you know, I had dinner with you in my dream, and you'll say, well, I don't have any memory of that. And because nobody else agrees with my dream experience, I consider that it was unreal. Whereas I'm going to get at least some degree of agreement about my waking experience. We're not going to all agree exactly. You know, it was interesting. I was giving a lecture this morning at the temple at our farm at New Varshana, and someone who hadn't attended talked to someone who told her what I talked about, and what they said I talked about was different than what I thought I talked about. So sometimes people who share the same experiences don't literally share every detail of them, but enough so that we feel that enough people agree with me, it must be real. Now, could it be possible that we're all in a shared illusion? Is that possible? We have one really good example. Again, a movie is a shared illusion. We're all watching the same movie, but it's an illusion. And another really good example is computer games. I think that's actually a better example. The scriptures give an example of dreams, because when these scriptures were written, they were not computer games and movie theaters, or I'm sure they would have used those examples. But when people play computer games, they all enter into a virtual world where they interact with each other in that world, and they have a shared experience in that world. But it's not the real world. Correct? And what you're doing in the computer game is not what you are actually doing. You are actually sitting in a chair, moving a joystick or a mouse or something like that. That's what you're doing, or typing on a keyboard. But it appears that you're running and jumping and talking and buying things and whatever people do in computer games, and that you're interacting with other people, again, who are having a shared experience. But what is actually happening in a computer game? We could talk about it. Let's talk about it in terms of hardware. What is it really? It's plastic and glass and metal.
Mathematics.
Okay, software is mathematics. Ultimately, it's just ones and zeros, isn't it? So software is just ones and zeros. So you could say that what's actually happening is a combination of just ones and zeros. Pretty amazing that from ones and zeros, you can get a whole illusory world. That's amazing. Or you could say what's happening is electricity. I get so many cups of tea. Just be careful for all the recording devices here. Thank you. You could say what's happening is, again, the metal and the plastic. And somebody's engineered it. Somebody's written the program. If it's an internet game, somebody's running the servers and all that. And to some extent, they're controlling the experience that you have, right? You can't have an experience that's outside of the program, or that's, and if the servers shut down or the electricity goes off, there's nothing you can do to enter into the game again. So you're not the only doer of the game, of what you're doing in the game. There's so many other people who are also doers. You're one factor. And basically what it is you're expressing your desire through the keyboard, through the mouse, through the joystick. That desire gets translated into a virtual body on the screen that then does sort of the things that you can desire as long as you play by the rules of the game. And you experience emotions in relation to what you're doing in the game, isn't it? Just like watching a movie. You know, I haven't played those games, but I've watched people play those games, and they get very excited, or they get very unhappy, and they're very angry. You see this with people watching sports also, same kind of phenomenon. I was once at someone's house where their son was watching a game on television. And at one point he jumps out of his seat and starts yelling at the guy on the TV. Okay? You know, so... That's fairly common, isn't it? You know, it's almost as if he's right there on the field. Hey, go get, you know. He's having an emotional experience of being there, whereas actually he's not. So Krishna's saying that all our experience in life is exactly like that. Except that this illusion is so amazing that I don't have practically any hint that it's an illusion. You know, when you're playing a computer game, when you're watching a movie, when you're reading a book, you have some sense that you have an identity that's separate from the illusion. You retain something. I mean, even when you're deeply involved in it, there's still a concept that I have an identity that's separate from this and I'm not really doing this. You never forget completely. Whereas this illusion, we completely forget. And it's so clever. We actually, you know, feel like I'm in this body walking around and doing things. That this is me moving around. But Krishna is saying here, no. That's not what's happening. You're just a witness. He says it also again in the fifth chapter. He says, while you're eating, while you're sleeping, while you're talking, while you're doing... He said, actually, you're doing nothing. Of course, you're doing something. You're desiring and you're witnessing. But you're not actually doing what you think you're doing. So the person in the movie theater is doing something. They're sitting, they're witnessing, they're associating, but they're not jumping off the helicopter. So I am... witnessing and desiring, but I'm not eating. Right now, I'm not talking. We're not actually all sitting here. We're just witnessing. Pretty amazing, huh? And the fact that I'm not doing any of those things, that I'm just witnessing, is one of the main reasons why every once in a while, in a human body, at least, you say, there's something funny going on here. Something's just not right. What it is. Something strange about this place. I mean, it comes out in several ways. Sometimes when you get everything that you wanted and it didn't give you the satisfaction that you expected, that's one of those signs when it happens. You know, when you think, okay, I'm going to work really hard, I'm going to go to school and I'm going to graduate. And you walk up on stage and you're in your gown and your funny hat and you go up there and you get the diploma and you're just like euphoric. And then the next day you think, I'm really not any smarter than I was yesterday. I'm the same person. You know? Do you know that psychological studies have shown that when a person wins the lottery, within 6 months, they're back to the same level of happiness that they were before they won the lottery. They're happier for a while, and then within 6 months, it's right back. And the same happens if you become a paraplegic, you get crippled. Within 6 months, you're back to your same level of happiness. So it's things like that's because none of those things are actually happening to us. So it's when things like that happen, you know, when we get everything we want and we say, is that all there is? You know, I don't know how many of you are old enough that you could have gotten all those things, but you know, if you get the perfect partner and you get the perfect house and the perfect car and the perfect job, and then you look around and say, that's it? I did everything that the adverts told me to do, and that, you know, the politicians and the corporations and my teachers and all the popular mag, I did everything they told me to do, and like, that's it. That's all there is. It's just that. You know, you go to what we saw advertised, so what, Cook Island, or you go to Tahiti, or... okay, it's pretty. And it's like, that's it. It's just pretty. It's just a beach. Just a coconut? Okay, that's it. So that's one of the times that we have a little hint that something's not right. Another time we get that hint is that we don't seem to really be able to get what we want. Now, I want to be vibrantly young and healthy forever. And I just can't do it. And everybody wants that. Nobody wants to be tired and worn out and old and incapacitated, right? Nobody wants that. Sometimes people want to die because they're so unhappy in life. But nobody wants to become unhappy or not full of, you all want to be full of vitality, always. And you just can't do it. You know, you can take the right vitamins and you can exercise and eat all organic food and you're still going to get old. You know, even people who live really healthy lives get old, and when you get old, your vitality decreases. It just does. You get sick, and then you die. You know, that's kind of weird. No, none of us want that to happen. And it happens. And that's another little clue that there's something funny here. You know, there are creatures in the desert who never drink water. They don't have a desire for water. But if you're a water-drinking creature in the desert, you want to drink water. So we have this desire for something that's not obtainable. If this is reality, why isn't it satisfying to me? Or like, we all would like happiness that doesn't have an end. None of us want our happiness to end. We don't go, I mean, we may make so many philosophical statements, well, you have to take the good with the bad, and the pain helps you appreciate the pleasure and so many things. But normal people don't sign up for pain. You don't go to a doctor and say, please give me a disease. We just don't do that. We don't fall in love with someone and say, listen, I really want to experience heartbreak. Make sure you walk out on me after a month. Please cheat on me with my best friend so I'll find out what it's like to be heartbroken. None of us look for distress. We all want our happiness, whatever happiness we have, to go on forever, and it just doesn't. Whatever happiness it is, you know, a beautiful sunny day, sex, good food, driving our new car, I don't care what it is. The happiness stops. It decreases or it just stops. You have to get out of the car. You can't eat anymore. Or it gets boring. You get your nice new car, and after a while, there's just no kick anymore of getting in that car. It's just, no, it's just your car. It's not thrilling anymore. You know? You get your new gizmo. Why do people keep getting new gizmos? You don't get new gizmos just because your old one wore out. The thrill wears out. You get the new thing, wow, it does this, it talks to me. Then after a while it's boring. That's just every day. You just take it for granted that your phone talks to you. It just becomes normal. And then you have to get a new phone. I don't know, that sings to you or something. Dances down your countertop. And then after a while that's normal. It's not exciting anymore. But that's not what I want. I want something that's exciting, and not just I. Everybody wants it. So why is there a universal desire to have vibrant, healthy life forever, and a universal desire to have unlimited, ever-increasing, never-ending happiness? And it just doesn't happen. So every once in a while, when we realize that I want something that's just not obtainable, but still I want it, I can't just convince myself, I mean, I'll try, that, well, I don't really want it. I don't really want to be full of vitality and health forever. I don't really want that. I actually really want sickness and old age and death. I mean, actually, that's actually what I want. You know, we can try to talk ourselves into it, but it's not very effective. It's more you just resign yourself to it. You know, it's more I just kind of look at photos of myself and look in the mirror and go, there's not much I can do. I think, well, I could dye my hair and get plastic surgery, you know, but that's not really going to change anything.
Perhaps you could just be cynical and go, what's that?
You just be cynical, oh, it's all there is. We'll get it. But it doesn't really take away the desire. So those are little indicators that something's not right. What I want, I just can't get. What I get is not deeply satisfying to me, because it's not me. I mean, how deeply satisfied can you get by playing a computer game? Because it's not happening to you. Right? You can get a lot of money in your computer game, and if you're poor, still the only thing in your refrigerator is, you know, old bread and ketchup. Right? No matter how much money you have in the computer game. And you can marry some beautiful person in the computer game, and you still go back to your empty house. It doesn't really satisfy you. You know, the guy in the movie can be the hero and kill all the bad guys and save the world 3 seconds before it's going to blow up. And you're still just an ordinary Joe, you know, working in a customer service center where everybody yells at you all day. You don't become a hero by watching the movie. It doesn't really change you. So our material experiences is like this. It's the same thing. It doesn't really affect me. I have this feeling of emptiness. So why? Krishna's telling us why. He said all our happiness and distress, it's all external to us. We're not doing it. We're experiencing it only indirectly, vicariously. We're not directly experiencing it. All right. So, is there an alternative? Is there a reality? Or is the illusion all there is? Well, one evidence that there's a reality is that we all want something that's not here. As I said, we all want eternal life. We all want unlimited happiness. So turning to chapter 14. So in text 20, he says, when one properly sees that in all activities no other performer is at work other than the three modes of material nature. So when you start seeing, this is an illusion. That's not me. Then he says, when the embodied being is able to transcend these three modes, he can become free from birth, death, old age, and their distresses, and can enjoy nectar even in this life. If we can stop identifying with the false, then the word nectar is an interesting word, amritam. Mrita means death, amritam, without death, which is also often translated as nectar. We can actually have everything that we want. We can have an eternal vital life. We can have actually unlimited, ever-increasing happiness. We can also have, practically speaking, unlimited knowledge. But we have to walk out of the movie theater. We have to turn off the computer game. We have to transcend the modes of material nature. We have to stop identifying with the modes of material nature. Now, does that mean we just identify with nothing? You know, when you turn off a computer game, you're not just in a nothing. You're in your house. Right? When you walk out of the movie theater, you walk out into something. You don't just step out of the movie theater into, you know, a void. So there are people who teach that beyond the illusion is nothing. That's perhaps attractive if you're in a particularly painful illusion. You know, if the illusion you're experiencing is really awful, you might think that it would be better to be in a nothing. But that's not really what we want either. We want excitement. We want relationships. We want mystery. We want adventure. We want to learn something new. We want to have always novelty, safety and novelty, both peace and excitement. Learning new things, finding new things, doing things that are meaningful. That's what we want. We don't want just nothing. Okay, so we might ask, what is it like to be above the modes of nature, and how do I do it? And this question actually is asked by Arjuna. He says, by what symptoms is one known who has transcended the three modes? What is his behavior, and how does he transcend the modes of nature? I'm going to ask you to ignore the gender-specific language here. This book was translated a long time ago when in English the masculine pronoun was considered to be inclusive. So I'm old enough that when I was a little kid, you know, it was just mankind and he, and that sounded perfectly fine to me because that was just the way I was brought up. And as things change now when I read that stuff, it's sort of, he? So we haven't edited the books to have them conform to our present way of doing things. Maybe sometime we'll get a gender-neutral pronoun in English, like we or she or something like that. Okay, so here's a description of one who's transcended the modes of material nature. One who does not... This is in chapter 14, text 22 to 25, which is on page 623 in this book. If you have a... In that book, it will be a different page. This particular first sentence has been of great help to me in my life in helping me transcend the modes of material nature. And I think it's particularly helpful because it's very surprising. Do any of you remember what the three modes are? Those three colored lights that make up this whole illusion. Do any of you remember what they are? You said it about 20 minutes ago.
So they're red, yellow.
Huh? Red, yellow. Red, yellow, blue. But what are they? Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Which in English we would say is? Do you remember the Sanskrit more than English?
Good.
And ignorance, yes. Goodness or truth. Sattva means both goodness and truth. It also means... truth in the sense of reality, authenticity, real existence. Sat means something that exists, that's real. So the mode of goodness is the closest to... It's not ultimate reality, but it's the closest to reality. And then you have passion and ignorance. And I don't have time tonight to get into describing the exact nature of goodness, passion, ignorance. But I would suggest if you're interested in understanding those, that you read through, especially chapters 14, 17, and 18 in the Bhagavad Gita. But the basic principle of truth is it's illuminating. And the basic principle of passion is attachment, desires, and of ignorance is delusion. So Krishna says, one who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present or long for them when they disappear. So he's saying not even to be attached to illumination and not to hate delusion. Because the illumination of the mode of goodness is still part of the illusion. Goodness, passion, ignorance are all part of the illusion. Reality is something beyond all of those. The Vedic scriptures often describe reality as the fourth stage of consciousness beyond deep sleep, dreaming, and wakefulness. That is an entirely different stage of consciousness, often referred to as samadhi. And there's actually two different types of samadhi. One that's on the platform of the mind and one that's on the platform of ultimate reality. So do not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present or long for them when they disappear. So in each of our lives, these three modes combine in different ways at different times. For each of us as individuals. Each of us as individuals have a body and mind that's a combination of these. Just like the figures on the screen, they're a combination of different colors of the lights. So this body we're in is a combination of a particular combination. And our life story is also a particular combination. And at a certain time, a certain point in our life, one of these modes will be prominent. And for all of us, these modes are also prominent at different times of the day. For example, the mode of passion becomes prominent somewhere around like 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, which is why that's when everybody goes off to work. And the mode of ignorance becomes prominent in the evening. You know, criminals become active at night. That's when people want to drink and things like that, because the mode of ignorance is active. And very early in the morning, the mode of goodness is active, which is why that's a good time for meditation. And people whose mind and body are not very much in goodness don't know what to do early in the morning. You'll find that people who are out clubbing and et cetera, by about 3 or 4 o'clock, they have to go to sleep. There's this kind of window, isn't it, between like about 3 o'clock in the morning, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and maybe 6 or 7, when people who don't have much influence of sattva, they can't be active, they don't know what to do. It's like they don't know how to resonate with sattva. So there's certain times of the day that are influenced by the different modes. There's certain times of the year that are influenced by the different modes. There's certain parts of the planet that are more influenced by the different modes. And each of us have a body that's a combination of the different modes. So at certain times, there's going to be more delusion, just like sometimes we feel sad, or we feel depressed, or we feel hopeless. You know, or we feel really down about ourselves. Oh, you know, I'm never going to get this right. I've been trying for so many years, and I keep failing, and I'm no good, and I made this really terrible mistake, and oh, my God, if I told anybody I made this mistake, nobody won't talk to me. And so sometimes we get in delusion. Sometimes we're affected more by the mode of passion. Oh, if I can only get this, if I can only get that. I want to be a good person. I want people to know that I'm a good person, and I want to be honored. I want to do good things in the world. I want to build big buildings and make big corporations and have big kingdoms. The king. And I want to help people. I want to really help a lot of people so people will say, yes, he's a good man. And the mode of goodness is, I want to find purification. I want to get liberation. I want enlightenment. I want to find out who I am. I want to rise above things. I want truth. I want to be a good person, not so people will say I'm a good person, but so I can come to the light, I can come to the truth. That's the mode of goodness. That's also material. So we have those three different feelings. Sometimes we're interested in getting free from our distress and finding truth. Sometimes we're interested in getting things in the world and being a good person and having other people respect us and getting ahead and doing something that's really important in life. And sometimes we're just like, I just want to go to sleep. Or I'm just depressed, or I'm just lazy. So one who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral, knowing that the modes alone are active. So knowing this is just the movie. It's not me. Sometimes I'm going to feel energized to be a good person in this world by doing and making and building. And sometimes I'm going to be energized thinking, yes, I want to become purified. I want to become illuminated. And sometimes I'm going to be energized just to sit on my couch. But none of that's me. It's not me. It's how the particular lights are combining to play out the story. It has nothing to do with me. And I neither hate it or desire it. And not to think that the times when sattva guna are active, I'm spiritual. And those are all just the material waves coming and going, coming and going. I become an observer. I become like somebody walking through an electronic shop where there's movies playing on the screen to entice you to buy the monitors, but you're not watching the movies. You walk past and you see the guy jumping through the helicopter and you see the buildings bursting into flame and you see the beautiful woman and handsome man looking each other in the eye, and you don't care because you're not watching the movie. You don't care if the beautiful girl falls off the cliff. kidnapped by the evildoer, because you're just walking through the shop. It has nothing to do with you. So you start seeing the events of your own life like that. It's a story, it's an illusion. And what you do instead, who is situated in the self, and we're going to get in a moment to how one does that, so who regards alike happiness and distress, who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with an equal eye, who is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honor and dishonor, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activities, such a person is above the modes of material nature. I'm going to read a little bit from the purport of Srila Prabhupada to this verse. He says, when a living entity is in the material world, embodied by the material body, it is to be understood he's under the control of one of the three modes of nature. When he's actually out of the body, then he's out of the clutches of material modes of nature. But as long as he's not out of the body, he should be neutral. He should engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord so that his identity with the material body will automatically will be forgotten. When one is conscious of the material body, he acts only for sense gratification. But when one transfers the consciousness to Krishna, sense gratification automatically stops. One does not need this material body, and he does not need to accept the dictations of the material body. How does he become aloof? He does not desire to enjoy the body, nor does he desire to get out of it. Thus, transcendentally situated, he becomes automatically free. The next question concerns the dealings of a transcendentally situated person. The materially situated person is affected by so-called honor and dishonor offered to the body, but the transcendentally situated person is not affected by such false honor and dishonor. He performs his duty in Krishna consciousness and does not mind whether someone else honors or dishonors him. He accepts things that are favorable for his duty in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, he has no necessity of anything material, whether stones or gold. He thinks that everyone is his dear friend who helps him in Krishna consciousness, so he does not hate his so-called enemy. He's equally disposed and sees everything on an equal level because he knows perfectly well that he has nothing to do with material existence. Social and political issues do not affect him because he knows the situation of temporary upheavals and disturbances. He does not attempt anything for his own sake. He can attempt anything for Krishna, but for his personal self, he does not attempt anything. By such behavior, one becomes actually transcendentally situated. So how does one come to this platform of total freedom? This is in the next verse. One who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman or spirit. Okay, so what does that mean? I have a real world. There is a reality. I have a real self and I'm part of a real world. If I constantly engage in activities of that reality, I am automatically above the false illusion. Pretty sensible. If I'm always engaged in real activities with my real family, then I'm never attracted by the computer game. Simple. So I have real activities that are actually me, that I am really doing, that are eternal, that are meaningful, that are authentic. If I am doing those activities, then I am detached from the illusion, and I'm not affected by the illusion. I'm not affected by the ups and downs of the illusion. I'm not affected even by the nice parts of the illusion, like illumination, or having something nice in the mode of passion. It just doesn't bother me. So our process that we teach in the Hare Krishna movement is how to be absorbed in reality. And what's really interesting is this absorption in reality does not necessarily, and in fact at the present time does not generally, entail that you move away from a city and you go up to some mountain cave and you sit perfectly still. That is a bona fide process. That's not a false process. To go away from society, to sit alone, to not do anything with the body, and to simply meditate within on the eternal reality, which, by the way, exists within us all the time. It's always there. Just like the person playing computer games, the rest of their family and their house are always there around them. They're just not looking at it. That's just not where they're putting their attention. So the reality is always within us. Always. So that is one way to do that. But for most people, it's really not recommended to just stop everything. First of all, it's very difficult to just stop everything. And most people can't maintain it. And it involves a period of doing something very unnatural. Because if you just stop everything, then you're not experiencing any illusory happiness, but in the beginning you're not even going to be experiencing any spiritual happiness either. It's very difficult. But what that process is, it's like if you have the illusion, you know, your hands are full of illusion, and first you try to empty it little by little by little till you have empty hands. And then you try to fill it with the reality. And that's hard. It's kind of hard to walk around being empty. It involves a long period of emptiness and dissatisfaction. So although that process is described in the Gita, there's a very nice comparison between that process and the process that we recommend in the 12th chapter. So the process that we recommend is to gradually churn illusion back into reality. To take the things that one normally does in illusion and start doing them for reality. Because in another sense, what makes the illusion is our consciousness, not the things. Because even the three lights and the projector screen and the body, there's some reality there. It's not the guy jumping off the helicopter, but it is three lights. The three lights does exist. It's not the computer figure jumping off the mountains, but it is ones and zeros, and it is electricity. It's something. There is something about it that's real. So there is something about even our illusion that has some reality. And it is possible to use the illusion to discover the reality, which is really good, because illusion is all we have to work with at first. I can't immediately just, well, I could, theoretically, but from a practical point of view, I'm not able to immediately access the reality just by saying, I want to. The reason for that is that when we say I want to, it's not a deep I want to, by the way. And the essence of our process is getting to a very deep I want to. Getting to an absolute, total, unconditional I want to. I want what's real, totally, completely, without conditions, no matter what. As soon as you get to that point, you're in reality. You find out who you are. We all have an eternal body. We all have a spiritual identity that's eternally youthful and vibrant and powerful and free, that we can go wherever we want and do whatever we want, except envy and hurt anybody. As soon as you want to envy and hurt anybody, you have to be an illusion. Or you can pretend to hurt people, because you can't really hurt anybody. So our whole process is getting us to the point where I want reality so much, and then it's immediately there. Krishna says early in the Bhagavad Gita, Yetaman prabhajante, tamstataiva bhajamyaham. As they respond to me, I reciprocate. So the essence of why we're an illusion is that we want to be an illusion. We desire it. So by using the illusion in the service of the reality, we start to experience the reality, we start to want the reality, we start to see how reality is so much better than illusion, and our desire increases, 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 and finally we say, okay, I'm ready to turn off the game. I'm ready to walk out of the movie theater. I'm done. Give me the real life. And we just say, bunch of ones and zeros. Now, the details of our Krishna conscious process certainly resemble religious rituals. And they can be taken that way. And there are people who take them that way. There are people who say, I'm Hindu and this is my religion and this is my religious rituals. But we can say, I don't want to say all, but practically all of the religions in the world and the rituals of the religions in the world, at least originally, were a process to rediscover reality. That's the original purpose of all spiritual and religious paths. It doesn't necessarily stay that way. That's also in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, yadayadahi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya. When the actual truth starts turning itself into falsity, when the process of finding reality starts to become itself part of the illusion, then you have to reassert it. You have to fix it again. So it may appear, well, this is some ritualistic formula. Okay, you say some mantra and you chant on beads and you count a certain number of beads and you eat only vegetarian food and you have some ritual of offering that food in an altar to consecrate it and you sing certain mantras and songs and, you know, so you like put some clay on my forehead that I put on with certain mantras. And all those things you can say, well, those are just rituals. But they're rituals to uncover reality. If you do them just superficially, it takes a very long time for them to work. Because you have to get from doing them superficially to doing them deeply. If you do them deeply immediately, they work very quickly. And again, you can say, well, it looks like a religion, it looks like some rituals, and religions are so much trouble, they're just politics. And somebody says, my religion and your religion. So it's an unfortunate fact that systems of spirituality tend to degrade to that. And the system we're teaching also degrades to that, by the way. The system we're teaching is not immune to being degraded back into illusion. It's happened many, many times. And then again, it has to be revived. So our claim is, which you can test, that at this particular moment, we're in a period where it's been revived. That's what we're claiming. And you're free to be skeptical about that and test it and investigate it. I'm not expecting any of you to just believe that, because many people are going to say that. But we say the process that we're teaching at this particular point in time still exists in its pure form and will give you the real thing. That will not be true forever. The prediction is that this process is going to increase in the world in purity, and that eventually the whole world will be coming to a golden age where people in general are becoming enlightened, and then again it will start to decrease, so that about 9,500 years from now, the process we're teaching will no longer be available in a pure form. And then again, it will have to be revived. Somebody will have to come, some great soul will have to come and again revive it. But at least at this point, if you try it, you will see that it's something special, that it gives you an experience that's authentic. There's a different quality to an illusory experience, an authentic experience, just like there's a different quality to dreaming that you're eating and eating. It has a different quality. There's a different quality to watching somebody make money in a movie and making money out of a movie. And there's a different quality to actual authentic happiness and illusory happiness. And even a beginner can experience this. So I remember I was once traveling in Germany, and there was some man who was just kind of traveling around Europe. And he just happened onto our property there. He happened to be there while we were having a big festival. And after a couple of days of asking questions, he said, I think I'd like to try chanting. So he took some of our beads and he went out in the woods on our property. He was gone for maybe half an hour. And he came back and he said, that should be a controlled substance. So that's... And I remember when I was in university and I first decided that I was really going to get serious about practicing Krishna consciousness. And the way I thought of it was the difference between having your voice amplified with a microphone and speaking loudly. That was how I thought about it. In other words, that it was authentic. It was something that was real. That any of my other experiences in life that I thought were spiritual or just... I could tell that they were phony. That I had touched something that was genuine. That was experiencing my real self. Was like, oh. This is what I wanted in everything else that I was doing. but I wasn't able to achieve it because everything else that I was doing was with the illusion. So the most basic part of our process is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Now, should I explain why that is so powerful or not? Did I do that? It's really far out explanation, are you sure? It's probably going to totally blow your mind. It's so much more far out than anything else that I've said. Are you sure? We can just leave it at this. Just say, just chant Hare Krishna, check it out. Or should I tell you what chanting Hare Krishna is? Are you sure? Well, a little later on in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that this world is like a big tree that's upside down. A really big tree, a really complex tree, a banyan tree. Have you ever, seen a banyan tree? Who has ever physically seen a banyan tree? Anybody have been to a place? And who's seen a picture? Have anybody seen a picture of a banyan tree? Really complicated trees because the branches send out roots. So it's like a banyan tree, a very complex tree that's a reflection in the water, shimmering. So it looks like a tree, except it's upside down and it's shimmering. So it's distorted and upside down. But there's a real tree on the bank that's being reflected. So the nature of reality is that it's the perfect exhibition of the illusion. Now, what is the top thing people are looking for in this illusion? You can say it, sir. What is it?
Pleasure.
Pleasure, what pleasure specifically? What's the top thing, like the ultimate success? A romantic relationship, right? Isn't it? Listen, most spiritual and religious systems in the world today are teaching you that in the reality there's no romance. They're wrong. They're saying there's either nothing, or it's just like some clouds and people going, Gloria. But we say that in the ultimate reality, there's a supreme, absolute truth, what's totally true, and this total, complete truth is a young man and a young woman. This young man's name is Krishna. He's also called Rama. And this young woman's name is Hara. Now, in Sanskrit, when you talk to somebody, you change their name. So, like, my name is Urmila. If we spoke Sanskrit and you were speaking to me, you wouldn't say, oh, Urmila, you'd say, oh, Urmile. They change the name to show you're speaking to someone. So, like, if you're going to say Krishna went somewhere, you say Krishnaha. If you're going to talk to Krishna, you say, oh, Krishna. So, when you talk to Hara, you call her Hare. So, what's happening in the ultimate reality is this wonderful, spiritual, non-exploitive, lust is a selfish, exploitive feeling. But actual, pure romantic love, the kind of love we talk about and don't really achieve. You know, the sort of, that kind of love. That's what they have. And everyone in the reality shares the happiness of their love. Something like, if you go to your friend's wedding, you also feel happy? Right? You found out your friend found the perfect girl or the perfect guy, and you share their happiness, and they want you to share. Right? When you get married, you usually want a wedding where you invite your friends because you want to share your happiness with your friends. So that's the ultimate reality. A young man, a young woman who are beautiful, in pure love, and everyone else sharing in that love. So the Hare Krishna mantra, Hare Krishna, means you're bringing together Hare and Krishna. Hare Rama, you're bringing together Hare and Rama. And you're sharing in that joy of ultimate love. Which is why when people chant the Hare Krishna mantra, they see that the illusory things in this world just look like ones and zeros. Because they're tasting that real love. And this is also why sometimes when people chant Hare Krishna, they decide to lead a life of celibacy. Not because they're frustrated or they're angry, hopefully. Some of them perhaps. But if they're really chanting the Hare Krishna mantra deeply, it's because they're already experiencing the real thing that this world is just a shadow of. And if you've got the real thing, you're not very interested in the shadow. Now, that doesn't mean people can't get married and have children in our spiritual process. But we're actually experiencing the real thing. So that's the secret of the Hare Krishna mantra. It is a bringing together the ultimate reality and rejoicing in that. It's a very, very joyful mantra. And the mood of the mantra is, I want to serve, I want to give to this ultimate reality. I want to give everything. Just exactly like you go to a friend's wedding. You want to give them a present, and you want to give them a hug, and you want to share your best wishes, and you want to do everything you can to contribute to their happiness because you're feeling their happiness. You're not thinking about your own happiness. Your own happiness is automatically included in the happiness of your friends. So that's what chanting Hare Krishna is. Where you have a mood that I want to give myself, instead of to illusion, I want to give myself to the reality, and I find happiness in the happiness of reality. Interesting, isn't it? So it's a very simple mantra, only three words, Hare Krishna and Rama. You can see here how it's put together. And there's a science as to how it's put together. So this is the essence of our spiritual practice. This is the most essential, most powerful part of our spiritual practice. But this is not all of our spiritual practice. Our spiritual practice is 24 hours a day. That everything one does in the service of reality. With a slightly, just a little change of consciousness. Tiny, tiny, tiny change of consciousness. And a few things you can't do. There's just not very many. There's a small list. Don't harm anybody. So, therefore, we're vegetarians. No unnecessary harm. Some harm you can't help. You know, you walk down the street, there's some bugs under your shoes. What are you going to do? You can't float. You know, there's just... some violence is just there, and you can't do anything about it. But the least amount of harm that you can cause in life, to anybody, not just to humans, to plants, to anybody or anything, to tread as lightly as possible. So you can't offer anything in the service of reality that's cruel and violent and nasty and envious and greedy. So anything that's not like that. You know, you can't run a prostitution ring and offer that in the service of the reality, or, you know, be a drug dealer, cut off animals' heads and offer that in the service of the reality. So those sort of things. Can't cheat people. Gambling is a very sophisticated kind of cheating where you all agree. We all agree that we're all going to try to cheat each other. There's no honest exchange of goods and services. So anything like that, that you can't offer in the service of reality. But other than that, everything can be done in the service of reality. So that's a detailed science, which I don't have time to explain now in depth. But if you're interested in learning how to do that, that's explained very much in the Bhagavad Gita and our other books. And anyone here at the loft can also help you to learn how at every minute of the day you can actually be in the service of reality. And then what will happen is gradually the concept, your concept of the world will change. You'll start to perceive the world as it is. And you'll start to perceive the ultimate, eternally happy, unlimited reality that's within you. And you'll start to live in that reality. At which point you'll be free of all external circumstances. So you can give it a try. If it doesn't work, you can always go back to the movie theater. So questions, comments, discussions? Yes?
Here in the ultimate reality where Krishna and Radha are enjoying pastimes, does that mean that there's no, you don't have any personal loving exchanges like they're having, like the only love that exists is between Krishna and Radha? and we're observing that and serving them, helping them enjoy more. But does that mean you don't have that?
No, part of serving them and helping them enjoy more involves also your personal relationships. Again, let's take the analogy of a wedding. You also have some relationship with the people getting married. It's not that you're only facilitating the relationship with each other. And you have a relationship with the other people at the wedding.
So you can bring your wife to the wedding?
Why not?
Hopefully you will bring
There's Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj in Krishna's pastimes also. So many. Everything is there. But the difference is that the center is Radha and Krishna. And the reason the center is Radha and Krishna, I'm part of them. You know, in this world, if I just work for your happiness, after a while I'll become disgusted, because no matter how happy you are, ultimately it's not going to make me happy. You know, in this world, if I just try to make my husband happy, or my wife happy, or my kids happy, or my country happy, or my employer happy, or my rugby team happy, you know, eventually I'll just see that I'm not really part of that. I'm not really part of my country. I'm not really part of my rugby team. I'm not really part of my family. I'm not really part of my employer. And their happiness doesn't ultimately make me happy. But I am really part of Krishna. So, you know, we're trying to do the same thing. But I am genuinely part of Krishna. But no, I also have my relationship with Krishna, with Radharani, and with everybody else there. With everybody. Is that all right? Very good question, buddy. Are you all satisfied or scared? Or?
Deep in thought.
Deep in thought, okay. Yes?
Like, if you're not happy when others are happy, if you're not sad when others are sad, then you're not with the people and you're kind of secluded.
So you're worried that if you were detached from illusion that you lose your sense of connection?
Kind of, yes.
Okay. Oh, very good question. Thank you. But all other people also have a real existence. Now, what kind of connection do you want with other people? A false connection or a real connection? If you're absorbed in the reality, yes, you will lose your false connection. But if you're absorbed in the reality, guess what? You'll get a real connection. Yes, you will lose your false connection. I agree. But you'll have a connection in reality. You'll feel much more connected to people. Because you'll be actually connected to everybody. You won't be pretending anymore. But yes, you do have to be willing to give up the pretense to get the real thing. And in the process we're teaching, you don't have to give up all the pretense completely, totally, before you can experience the real thing. You give up a little bit of the pretense, you get a little bit of the real thing. You get up a little bit more of the pretense, gradually and proportionally. So your hands are never empty. Your hands will never be empty. We are not teaching a process of first empty yourself of illusion and then accept the reality. We are not recommending that process. That process does exist, but that's not what we're recommending. So that means you will never be without some sort of connection. As you start getting the real connection, you know, you'll start out with 99% illusory connection, and you'll add 1% real connection. And gradually the percentage will keep increasing and increasing and increasing. Once it gets to about 40, 50% of being a real connection, once you get to about that, somewhere that, maybe 60, 70%, that's when your consciousness is going to undergo a major shift. That's like a tipping point, which is described in the Shastra as Nishta or Brahma-Bhuta. At that point, you actually transcend the modes of nature, although you still have some illusion left, which is very interesting. So our process is gradually and proportionately you let go of the illusion and replace it with reality. Even for those people who fully and completely taken up the process, that's all they do, they're just monks, they're still doing that gradually. they're still gradually adjusting their consciousness. You can do it suddenly, but for most people, you really can't, if that makes any sense. It is possible to have an immediate absorption in reality totally. That's possible. Because that's our natural state and it's within us. That happens sometimes, but very rarely. Mostly because we don't want to do it. We generally have to gradually build up trust and courage. So in this process, your connection with people will gradually become more and more and more and more authentic. Even if they're still an illusion and they're relating to you falsely, it won't matter. Your understanding of them and your ability to relate to them will become more and more real. Your ability to understand their happiness and distress will be more and more real and more and more deep. You won't be swept up in it. You can't really understand something, by the way, when you're swept up in it. You'll genuinely understand it. Yes.
So what's happening during this process of gradual replacement of unreal with real? Is it a change of desire or quality?
It's basically a change of desire, yes. It's a change of the quality and the object of desire. That's the essence of what's happening. Yes. That's one way to explain it. I mean, there's other ways of explaining it. You could explain it as a lessening of fear and replacing it with love. That would be one way of explaining it. You could explain it as a lessening of ignorance and an increasing of knowledge. You could explain it as a lessening of bondage and an increasing of freedom. So it's there's many ways you could look at it, and they're sort of looking at different aspects of the same thing. And you know, the sacred writings and the saintly persons will sometimes describe it in different ways at different times. It's an awakening of your real self. It's something like if you're in a drama, I mean, that's another kind of falsity that also is explained, like you're in a drama, and in a drama you're wearing a costume and you're wearing makeup and you've assumed another persona. You've taken on, mentally and emotionally, if you're doing a good job anyway, you've taken on the characteristics of the person you're playing. And then after the drama, you gradually remove that. You don't usually just, if you're a good actor, you don't just snap back into your persona, your actual self. And you know, you take off your costume bit by bit, and you wash off your makeup bit by bit, and you come back to who you are. And you start saying, oh, this is who I really am. So they can also be described like that. That sometimes it's described that it's a dissolving of the false identity. That actually, because you're basically, what you're doing there is you're not doing anything to feed it anymore. So you're not feeding it, it sort of fades away and dissolves. And you're feeding the real self, and so that self starts unfolding and awakening. The real self is right now, our real self is existing in a seed-like state. It's just a witness and desire, and its real form is not, it's dormant. It's kind of like inside of a seed where the real form of the plant is there, but it can't really do anything with it. And as you start doing spiritual activities and spiritual consciousness, you nourish that actual form. And you stop giving nourishment to the illusion. I mean, I like to think of it like you buy one of these packets of seeds in the store, you know, it has a little picture on the cover of the thing. So right now, it's like I'm a picture of a person. It's not the real me. And let's say you took the whole seed packet and put it into water. The paper would dissolve and the seeds would sprout. So that's another way of understanding that this. The illusion just, I put the whole thing in spirituality. I take my body, my mind, my circuit, I just immerse it in spirituality. And the illusion dissolves and the reality starts sprouting. Actually, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains like that, that it's like a seed that sprouts and starts getting leaves and gradually grows and then develops flowers that turn into fruits, and then you get to eat the fruit. Finally, you get to know who you are. And there's very detailed descriptions of the emergence of our real identity. How old we are, what we look like, what our personal tastes are, what colors we like, everything, what we want in reality, gradually, step by step, emerges. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes 11 facets of our ultimate identity that gradually reveal themselves as our false identity dissolves. Yes?
How long does it generally take following the Rukmini process to get to this tipping point?
You really...
Is it like an average length of time?
I don't think so. And one reason is that we're not all starting at the same point. So, I didn't talk today about karma and reincarnation, but if you've started this process in other lives, then you're ahead of somebody who's starting in this life. And how far you've gone. Whatever you do in spiritual awakening stays with you from one life to the next. It can become... it's kind of like money in a bank. You might go through a period where you don't access it, but it's not going away. It stays there. That's unlike... You know, your material stuff doesn't really stay from one life to the next. You may have some inclination, but you have to learn your alphabet all over again in your next life, kind of thing. So, you know, you're a Nobel Prize winner in one life, and next life you're saying goo goo gaga, and you got to start all over. But with spiritual realization, it's not like that. With spiritual realization, whatever point you've come to in realization, as soon as you take up the process again, you can access what you already have. So we're not all starting at the same place. So that's one thing. And there may be some people in this room who are already like 90% there. For them, it may be a matter of a week or a month or a year. And somebody else who's starting at the beginning, it may be longer. Then it also depends on how serious you are, like anything else. You know, materially, they say it takes 10 to 13,000 hours to become expert at something. They can give a time to it. There's actually studies done. If you want to be an expert computer programmer or violin player or whatever, ice skater, whatever you want to do, to become a master takes 10 to 13 hours of concentrated work. So I 10,000 hours. So we can't give a specific time like that. But we can say that it does take repeated practice. It does depend on your seriousness and how long. That's not. I mean, one thing I should say is this is not a mechanical process. This is a process ultimately of awakening love and awakening desire. How long does it take people to awaken love and desire? I don't know. Some people very fast. Some people not very fast. Some people really struggle with that kind of thing. Materially speaking, I mean, how long does that take? I don't know. You can't, you know, you can give a formula, like you could give a formula for things in this world. You know, what does it take to have a successful business? Or what does it take to have a successful romantic relationship? Or what does it take to have a successful friendship? But whenever we're talking about dealings between living beings, your formulas only go so far, isn't it? You can't say, well, if you give the girl roses every day, within 5 days she'll fall in love with you. Maybe she'll fall in love with you in 5 minutes, and maybe after 5 years she's still not in love with you. You know, it's a hard thing. So, please don't look at a spiritual process as a set of mechanical rituals. It's not. It may appear to be that superficially, and as I say, in every spiritual system, it ultimately degrades to that and has to be revitalized at some point. But it's not. It's a system of awakening love and desire. Now, there are ways that you can accelerate the process, and there are ways you can slow the process down. If you want to slow the process down, be very critical of others and harm others. That'll make it take a long time. Okay? Anything you do that's harmful, critical, envious, anything you do that's any kind of violence, psychological, verbal, physical violence, will slow the process down considerably. So that's the main way you can make it take a long time. If you want to accelerate it, have a deep desire to know the truth, even if sometimes the truth is not going to be attractive at first. Because some of the first things that you'll see when you start seeing truth is that you're a fool. Because only a fool is attracted to illusion in the presence of reality. That will not be a pleasant thing to see. Absolutely guarantee you, promise you, it will sting. And to be willing to see that, and to be willing to see that over and over and over again until you start accumulating enough of that, of a grounding in reality that it becomes pleasant. Which it will. But there will be... It's not pleasant to know that you've really done something foolish. To think that I can get pleasure from ones and zeros and lights dancing on a screen is a really foolish thing. And our whole life is like that. And you'll see some interesting things at first. You'll see that what you thought was kindness on your part was actually envy. And if you don't want to see that, if you run away from it, the process will take a long time. If you're willing to see it and you're willing to deal with it and you're willing to say, wow. Wow. Okay. Let's go on. Then it will go very quickly. So those are the things you're looking at. And if you ask more experienced people, I mean, part of this path is accepting guides, accepting masters who will guide you. They'll give you personal guidance that you can go to and say, okay, this is what I'm coming to, and what's happening here, what do I do with this? And I have seen people who advance very quickly. I've seen people after, you know, 3, 4, 5 years are very, very advanced on the path. And I've seen other people after 40 years, they've hardly gotten anywhere. Seriously. So that's... I'm not going to say it's entirely under your control because you're dealing with something, you're dealing with life. And the ultimate absolute reality is a living person. An amazing, spiritual, unlimited person, not just ordinary person, but the ultimate truth is personal. So you're dealing with a personal relationship. It's not, so it's not all on your side. Personal relationship, it's two-sided. At the same time, to a very large extent, it's under your control. But I can't give you some sort of, after this time, this will happen, after this time. I can say, if you do these things, this is what's most likely to happen at this time. Is that all right? Yes.
This is a question I was asked you at the temple. How can you know what progress you're making? How can you gauge your own progress?
Excellent.
And how can
question.
You be patient with yourself? How can you give a concrete, practical example of how to develop patience on the spiritual path and not, you know, beat yourself up?
Okay, let's look at two questions separately. So if let's look at patience first. How to develop patience? Hang around with people who are further along than you. At least some of the time. It's good to hang around with people who are at the same level because it's nice to have friends who are at the same level and who you kind of can journey together. But hang around with people who are more advanced than you, that gives you a lot of confidence and the willingness to be patient. How else can you develop patience? I think by honestly admitting that the reason I sometimes take my time is that I'm not willing to do everything immediately. Does that make sense? I've developed an attachment to illusion, and I'm not willing to give up all of my attachments immediately. I'm just not. I might say I am. You know, that's kind of the beginning fanatic convert. Yeah, I'm going to give it all, but it's nonsense. It's not true. And everybody who's hung around for a while goes, yeah, yeah. Sure. You know, so in the beginning there's this false confidence. I'm completely pure. want unconditional reality. Give me the truth. You try giving them a little of it and see how they react. So part of patience is just being honest with ourselves. How fast am I willing to progress? Because some of the beginning stages are difficult. They're difficult because I'm attached. They're not intrinsically difficult. It's just like if someone's become addicted to a drug. So becoming sober is a difficult process because they're addicted. Being sober is not difficult if you're not addicted. Now, I don't find it difficult not to drink. But if I become an alcoholic, I find it very difficult. So it's not that not drinking is difficult, but your attachment makes it feel difficult. So if you've allowed yourself to get addicted to illusion, then you have to realize that especially the initial stages of weaning yourself off from that may involve something that we could call austerity, which is, again, in every genuine spiritual process, there's some austerities. And to think, I am the one who allowed myself, I chose to become attached to illusion, and now I've got to have some patience with getting myself out of it. So I'd say those two things. Have some friendship and association with people who are more advanced than you, and realize that I'm the one who got myself into this mess. And I'm probably not willing or able to do what would be necessary to get out of it much faster. It may be too much for me. You know, I used to run schools, and sometimes you get kids coming to the schools who were behind in their studies. I got some kids who were 2 years, 5 years behind. You know, you give them a placement test, and you see they're way behind. And usually those kids, and always the parents, say, I want to get caught up as quickly as possible. But when you tell them what they need to do, they often don't want to actually do that. Or even sometimes you tell them and they say, okay, but then after 2 weeks they come to you, they say, I can't handle it. If you say, okay, instead of one math lesson a day, you're going to do two a day, they just say, I can't do it. So then we find a level where they're comfortable. So some, I was able to do things like catch up a kid. Over 2 years, I could catch them up 5 years worth of work. But even that, I mean, one kid I did that with, he was so determined. I am going to catch up to where I should be. And he was willing to do the austerity. So this is one thing also where you work with a master, you work with a mentor who can help you figure out what you're going to be able to maintain. And then you be honest and you say, this is the pace of progress that I am willing to maintain, that I'm not going to panic. And then you voluntarily say, okay, I'm going to be patient with that. Now, there does come a point, this tipping point. After that point, everything accelerates for everybody. So our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said, until that point, there's some amount of a hard struggle with determination. After that, everything comes very automatically and very easily. Kind of like going up a hill and then sliding down there. So that does come. And there, as I said, there are ways that you can accelerate the process, but you've got to be willing to do that. At a certain point, acceleration is exhilarating. When you're going down the hill, acceleration is exhilarating. When you're going up the hill, acceleration may not be so exhilarating. You know, and it's also intelligent to pace yourself properly so that you'll reach your destination and you're not just going to exhaust yourself after a week and say, that's too hard, I can't do it. Okay, and your other question was, how do I know I'm making progress? How do you know you're eating? Well, you can be fake eating. You can be chewing gum. Right? Or you can be eating food that has no calories, fake food. There's a lot of that, you know. Looks like food, tastes like food, no nourishment. So how do you know you're eating? You don't have to ask somebody else, am I eating? You feel nourished, and your hunger is satisfied, and you feel pleasure. So making spiritual advancement means that you're going to feel satisfied and nourished and joyful. And your interest in illusion will decrease. that you have something higher. Will you necessarily feel that way 24 hours a day as a beginner? No. But there'll be enough of it that you know that you're making progress. And as in any other progress, it's not always easy to tell your progress from one day to the next or 5 minutes to the next, but you can certainly tell it looking back a week or looking back a month. Am I becoming more joyful? Am I becoming more free? I should also say that the beginning stage is generally people, you know, if you get this analogy that like your hand is full of fake pearls, plastic pearls, and I'm basically taking out a plastic pearl and I'm putting in a real pearl, and I'm taking out a plastic pearl and I'm putting into a real. So at first, my main focus may be on getting out the fake ones. But after a certain point, after I've got enough real ones in there, my focus starts to be more on getting in the real ones. So often in the beginning, a spiritual practitioner's focus is on what's wrong with illusion and getting rid of it. We see this all the time. I work for our international magazine, and people will write articles just on what's bad about the material world and what's bad about it. So they're very negative. And gradually that starts shifting. Some people can have the positive shift from the beginning, which will make things also very nice and accelerated. If your focus is on Krishna and the reality from the beginning instead of just what's wrong with the illusion, that will make everything much more pleasant. Will make your journey pleasant. You'll feel much more satisfied all along. But that seems to be difficult for a lot of people. If you can do that, you're at a huge advantage. I don't know why, but so many of us seem to find that very difficult.
So because you judge yourself constantly.
You will at least get to a point that you won't do that very much anymore. So I think be patient with that too. Don't take it very seriously. It really isn't. We're souls. We're wonderful beings. We're part of God. We're eternal. We're youthful. We're powerful. We're loving. We're all good beings. We just happen to be dirty right now. It's just, you know. I gave the example the other day. It's like, I remember one of my grandsons when he had a cold, so, you know, he's got mucus running down his nose, and you know what, like, 2-3-year-old kids do when they have mucus running down their nose? You know what they do? You know, this. You know, they take their. So, you know, he comes up to his parents, and he's just got dried mucus all over his arms and all over his shirt. So the parents don't say, you know, okay, kid, we're going to give you away. But they wash him up. So that's the situation of the pure soul and illusion is something like that. We're still a pure soul. We're just kind of dirty. So don't focus on the dirt. That's actually the mode of ignorance, really. I'm so low, I'm hopeless, I'll never do anything, I'm so attached. When the mind does that, the one who does not hate illumination, attachment, or illusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear. One who does not hate illumination, attachment, or delusion when they appear, or long for them when they disappear. Don't even hate the delusion. When the delusion comes, I'm so mad. It's delusion. It's the mode of ignorance. It'll pass. It's not me. It's a mind. Just mind. Just the moving of this. Just the colored lights are moving and the blue light's on now. That's all. It'll go. Oh, I want enlightenment. See, I'll light on. It's not very important. None of that's me. Don't take it so seriously. It's not serious. Become an observer. I'm a wonderful person who's making a very foolish mistake. So I regret that I'm making a foolish mistake, and I rejoice in the fact that I'm a wonderful person. Sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you relish and rejoice in the self. He never says you hate the self. He says, by relishing and rejoicing in the self, you gain actual freedom from all miseries caused by material contact. So please never think humility is hating yourself. Humility is just honesty. I'm really small. Like, really, really, really small. Unbelievably small. My significance is only when I'm connected to reality in love. Then I'm very important. Just like a teeny tiny screw in a big machine is very important if it's in the machine functioning. And if it's out of the machine, it has no value. So I'm very important and very significant when I'm in my real, authentic position. In truth. I'm important and I love and I'm special and I'm unique and I'm needed. But on my own, I'm nothing. I'll be a one line in the obituary column if I'm really lucky. You know, if I really made it, I'll be a whole column in the New York Times. And I'll be remembered for one or two generations. Maybe. So you see both. See both. You see, on the level of illusion, it's all awful. It's just, I'm nothing, I'm insignificant, I can't do anything that has any real meaning, I'm contaminated, everything's useless. And on the level of reality, I'm wonderful. And I'm important. Me. I'm important. Boy, am I a fool. Okay. Okay, I think right now we have our wonderful vegetarian feast. Thank you very much.